current events,
personal values,
political and social issues,
technology, wars and tensions.
Join us for the next hour to discuss and learn how the things happening in our world today point to God's Word as signs of the times.
Good afternoon and welcome into Signs of the Times, our weekly look at Bible prophecy in the world's news for Friday, November 15th, 2019. Along with Pastor Mark Kirk, I'm Greg Hill. Thanks for joining us for the next hour as we dive into news headlines and things of interest as we plow through 2019 and screech towards the end of this year. It's amazing how quickly the year has gone, but we say that every year, I guess.
I know it does. It just goes faster all the time.
It really does. It goes faster all the time.
But quicker to the Lord's return, so that's all the better.
That's right. It is. It is. Don't forget our website, folks, thesigns.org, for everything related to our program, how you can listen through other sources like iTunes, Google Play, RSS feed, iHeartRadio, get the podcast, ask Pastor Mark a prophecy question, read the articles that we discuss, and listen to previous episodes, all at thesigns.org. Okay, so housekeeping note for our listeners, we are on episode 101. Episode 102 will not happen for the next 2 weeks. Matter of fact, I don't think until December, actually.
Wow.
Whatever that first Friday is in December.
Wow.
Because Pastor Mark will be out of town next Friday. And then the Friday after is when we're normally not on the air, because that is the Friday after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And so we're traditionally off during that time, usually playing Christmas music. We'll probably do that again for you then. So anyway, just a housekeeping note while I have your attention before you tune out at the end of the program to let you know we will not be back until the beginning of December. But with that, so we will miss the Friday before the Thanksgiving, which we usually talk about Thanksgiving. So today, Pastor Mark is going to talk about Thanksgiving with us and bring in a completely different point of view that he believes God showed him this very day as he was mulling about what to talk about the program. It's very exciting. And so take it away.
You know, the holidays have begun for me. I mean, I know we're still kind of, we usually Thanksgiving kind of kicks it in. But yesterday felt like the holidays had begun. So that's appropriate.
Okay.
That's a day now we look at the Thanksgiving, and I thought it'd be fun, again, because this is our last chance before Thanksgiving, as you said, Greg, to look at the true story of Thanksgiving. Here's the kind of thing that kind of grieves, or kind of actually grieves me a lot about our kids today, is they don't get the history. A lot of the history about our nation and about Thanksgiving and other things, they just don't teach it anymore. And basically what you see is maybe a play with Indians there and some people dressed in a pilgrim costume. And then they say they had Thanksgiving to thank the Indians. And that's kind of the message they give across.
It is. Yeah.
That is not the truth at all. They were no doubt thankful to the Native Americans, the Indians that were here, for helping them to learn how to survive. And we'll cover some of that when we get into this. But at the same time, there's so much more. The ultimate bottom line of this, Thanksgiving boils down to this. It was an opportunity, according to their own records, to give thanks to God, and I'll say this in my own way, to survive and thrive. So because they survived, and not only survived, they thrived, they had this massive Thanksgiving celebration to give God thanks for their thriving and their surviving and thriving. And they invited, of course, the Native Americans with them who helped them learn how to survive in this new land. And so we're going to talk about that. And then we're going to talk about some interesting experiments that led them to that success and look at human nature and really look at the way our nation started is kind of where we are today in many ways, ideologically or really mentally, might be a better word to use, because the pilgrims weren't really ideological in these views we're going to look at today. But, you know, it's very interesting when you think about it, because it's there's so much that goes on with it. I read a great account of Thanksgiving recently, and I put it down kind of in my own words to give the history of it and then make some observations about it, because it's so amazing. Now, do you have some comment? You have this look like you're ready to make some comment.
Well, what's amazing, because we do show prep, and we talk about, you know, what we're going to talk about on the show. And you mentioned one of the people you're going to talk about. And one of our listeners texted me a picture of his statue and what's inscribed at the bottom of it from William Bradford. So I don't want to say anything about it, because you might say the very same thing that's on the thing. So when we get to that, we'll talk about it. But I was just laughing, because it's like, even our listeners are getting like prophetic about what we're going to talk about.
I love it. Isn't that great? And I probably don't have that quote. That looked pretty long. I've only got a couple of short quotes here by William Bradford.
Yeah, chiseled in the marble of his statue.
Let me kind of read the history. Yeah. Let's all remember what Thanksgiving was really about, and then learn some things about human nature. And believe it or not, we're going to tie this into Acts by the time we're done. Because, again, they were doing something that we're trying to do now that even the early church tried to do. And, you know, we see what fails and we see what's successful, and we'll talk about it. But the story of the pilgrims begins in the early part of the 17th century. That's the 1600s. The Church of England under King James was persecuting anybody and everybody who did not recognize its absolute civil and spiritual authority. All right. The government was, and again, I'm quoting from this individual that I took this article from. The government was God. The government was the religion, and the government was the church. Again, these are all, you know, this is just the fact. That's what it was in that time. The government was everything. And there was an oppression on the people. And this is what really led, this whole oppression is what led them to find a new land. And those who challenged the government, King James, and the way he was running everything, who believed strongly in freedom of worship, were hunted down. They were imprisoned and sometimes executed for their religious beliefs that they held there in England. So it was a big deal.
Very big.
Anyway, it's interesting, Greg. I talked about how, and I'm going to interject things as we go through this, but I talked about how we've come full circle in America, which I'll point out in just a moment when that comes up. But England really has gone full circle. Did you know that on the British Isles right now, it is against the law to teach that there's only one way to heaven, that there's one way to get there? It's against the law to basically to preach the gospel. And this is the place where it started out that way. God sent a great revival and blessed them. Now they're going back to where they were. We started out that way based on what we're going to see today. Then now we're swinging back away from what God brought us. And it's just crazy how, you know, if you don't know history and you don't understand human nature, you're doomed to repeat it. And that's why history is so important. That's why it grieves me that we don't really have this history taught in our high schools today. And I understand why. It would be a spiritual battle, because it would lift up the Lord and bring God into things which the enemy doesn't want to do. But this is where a nation is successful. This is why England was eventually successful. And this is why we have been successful. Anyway, because they did this in England, a group called Separatists, most people know that name Separatists, a group of Separatists, people that didn't want any part of what King James was doing and all the oppression and making the rules and keeping everybody under bondage, they were fed up. They said, we've had it. And this is where a lot of people don't know. And this is something, Greg, I was educated on as I began to study a little bit more about Thanksgiving. They first fled to Holland. They didn't jump on boats and run to America. They first fled to Holland. And the pilgrims, they didn't come on the same route, you know, as people think in their mind, coming straight over from England. They fled to Holland and established a community there first. And after 11 years, 40 of them agreed to make a journey to what was then called the New World. So the pilgrims really came from Holland. They started in England, went to Holland, from Holland came over here from the New World, where they would certainly face, again, all these hardships that we read about historically. But the promise was that they could live and worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. So the bottom line is we fled our homeland. We don't feel that we're settled here in Holland. We want to find a place we can reestablish for ourselves and our descendants where we can worship God in freedom. So that was their driving force. The belief in freedom of religion to engage in this kind of activity in order to be able to do it, to be able to cross the ocean to a place where you have no idea where you were going, just to be able to worship as they chose. Think about that. They were willing to go across the ocean, Greg, to establish a society where they could worship as they wanted. And today, you know, I say this tongue-in-cheek, but I'm going to say it. Some of us have a hard time getting up in the morning and driving across town to go to church.
Yeah,
and they
funny.
Literally were willing to leave their lives behind, get on a boat and cross the ocean. Now, of course, that's one thing I can point out there, but here's another thing. This is why freedom of religion, not freedom from religion like these heretics, these weird people try to do, freedom of religion, they were willing to give their lives and to take a chance on drowning in the ocean, not making the journey, all these things.
And that would have been treacherous in that day.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Just to come to a new land to be able to do that, it was that important to them.
Yeah.
So when we think about some of our freedoms being taken away, even by the government now, by saying you can't do certain things based on conscience, and it's going that way. Churches being forced to do things, they're trying to do that. Individual doctors, nurses now being told that if you don't do certain things that you could lose your job. This is what they fought for. This is why they fled from Britain to come to America. Now, here's the sad thing. We've come to America, we've established this freedom, and we're allowing people around us to start closing in and taking it away again, even as King James did, even as that society did in that day. So August 1st, 1620, the Mayflower set sail. Now we're up to where most people probably know this part of the story.
Yes.
There were 102 passengers, including those 40 pilgrims that we talked about that had come from England and settled in Holland. The whole ship, again, not pilgrims. The pilgrims were led, if you will, not the whole ship. The whole ship wasn't pilgrims. But out of those 102, 40 of them were pilgrims. And those 40 were led by a man by the name of William Bradford. And again, that's a name most people know, even if you don't know much about Thanksgiving, you know the name William Bradford. On the journey, Bradford set up an agreement. Get this. He started making, Greg, a contract that would establish how they were going to establish their society when they got here. He said, I want to make sure when we get to the new land, we have a governmental system that we all agree on. So I'm going to write this up. I'll present it to the group. We'll all agree on it before we get there so that we're all on the same page. So he based it on just and equal laws for all members of the new community, which was to be irrespective of their religious beliefs. So where do the revolutionary ideas, where did the revolutionary ideas expressed in the Mayflower Pact come from, you might ask? Here's the bottom line, Greg. They came from the Bible. And this, again, is another reason that many people probably wouldn't teach this. Remember, these were a religious people looking for religious freedom. So when they came up with what their guideline was going to be as to how they operated their new society, they're in the new world, it was based on the Bible. Why? Because they had seen the success of the Bible. They believed in the success and the promises of God. So they believed if they established their society on that, that again, God would bless that. And he did. But they had to go through a journey first. The pilgrims, again, were completely steeped in the lessons of the Old New Testament. They knew the Bible backward and forward. And they looked to the ancient Israelites as for their example, because of the biblical precedents in Scripture, and they believe with all their heart because of that, this experiment's going to work because we're basing it on the Word of God. So we have this solid foundation to base it on.
Yeah.
Now, they were people of incredible faith, quite obviously, in the Lord and even in journeying to the new world because it was long, it was arduous, it was dangerous. And when they landed in New England in November, so here we are about to celebrate it, according to Bradford's journal, they found a cold, barren, desolate wilderness. That's how he described it. There weren't friends to greet them. You know, no dock, no hotels, no gas stations, no strip malls, nothing.
No Uber.
Rocks, that's right. No internet. You know, where's the internet, Dad? My iPhone's not working. Rocks and coastline is all they saw. There weren't any houses, that's it. And they realized, you know what? This is what we left. We left an established nation to come here to a forest that's cold in the winter to start our lives. I mean, this was like, in my mind, probably one of the worst. It could have been a worse landing, I guess, in December or January. But I mean, you're landing,
and you're in the northern coast of the eastern U.S. too.
Not landing in the winter.
Landing in Florida.
I mean, this was like really, really. It was. I mean, the deck was stacked against them, as they say. And during the first winter, again, get this: their first winter, Greg, half of them died. And this is sad to me, including William Bradford's own wife. She died. And of those 50 that died, they said that they died either of starvation, sickness, or exposure. And I think about not even able to get warm enough where the cold actually killed them. When spring finally came, here's the Indians coming to the story, okay?
Okay.
The Indians, the Native Americans, they taught the new settlers how to plant corn, how to fish for cod, to skin beavers for coats so they could be warm. And then life began to improve for the pilgrims. But at this point, they still were not prospering. They were surviving, but not yet thriving. And again, the purpose of Thanksgiving, they thank God because they were surviving and thriving.
Yeah.
So here's the important thing to understand, because this was where modern America, you know, our history lessons end today. pilgrims, they show up. They didn't know what they were doing. Nothing for them. No place to stay. They're starving. Indians fed them, showed them how to feed themselves with the kind of foods they would need and how to grow it here in this land, make coats for themselves, stay warm. And this, is, again, was the basis for Thanksgiving. It's going to culminate in that Thanksgiving time together. And while they were thankful to the Indians for helping them, which no doubt they were very thankful for that, history shows their true thanks, Greg, as we said, was for God helping them to survive and thrive, and their belief in him in Scripture, allowing their colony to form and their colony to ultimately, again, exist. And again, this is borne out by George Washington's first Thanksgiving proclamation, which we're not going to read today. I've got it, but we're not going to read it. And he made Thanksgiving a national holiday because, again, he kind of recaps what happened to these guys.
But this is way before George.
Oh, yeah. Now, again, George Washington's purpose, again, it was a holiday already rooted in God, and George Washington reiterated that it was rooted in God, even though today people don't want to note that. But everything that happened leading up to this was because of what God had done, and Washington and many of the founders felt divine inspiration throughout the entire period following the Pilgrims' arrival. In other words, when you read their writings, they say, you know what? We see that God intervened in this. God brought the Pilgrims here, and we see from our perspective as the founders of this new land, we see God's hand in every step of it. Now, we can look back in history and say we see God's hand. They were there. And they're saying, we saw divine intervention. This was not something that, you know, man has done. This is something that God has done. And again, this is a lot of the stuff that's omitted from the modern day textbooks. But this part here, the original contract, note this, the original contract that all the pilgrims signed aboard the Mayflower was for a specific reason. And this is great. You know, I don't know if I ever learned this, Greg, or if I'm being reminded of it, but they had merchant sponsors. When they came over, they didn't have the money to get here. So they had to get people, will you sponsor me to travel to the new land?
I've never heard of
that. Yes, and if you will, if you will, I will pay you back. And so what they knew was, they knew they had to come to the new land, be able to make it successful enough before they died to pay those people back. And the
Out of nothing.
And the people that let them borrow the money had to have faith.
Faith is that?
That God would do it through them.
Yeah.
Because they saw it this way. It's almost like missionaries. We'll send you. We're going to be a part of watching this new land established that God's doing because we see God's hand in it. And then you know what? Once you get established, you pay us back.
Amazing.
Yeah. So they had merchant sponsors. Again, they didn't have any money to sponsor their trip. It came from them. Again, the sponsors were from Holland and London. They'd gotten, again, people they knew in London, but also because of their stay of 11 years in Holland, they had sponsors there and had made friends there. So the contract called for everything the pilgrims produced, get this, because they all of them, every one of them came over here as debtors to pay people back that sent them. So they said, now we're going to write this up, how our government's going to work, but it has to be focused on paying them back first. So our whole thing is to come together, raise the money, pay back our sponsors, then we can begin to start our new nation. So they came here basically on a debt. It'd be like getting into your home and you owe the bank money. You got to pay that
mortgage,
right?
Yeah.
So again, when they sat down to make up this this whole thing, they decided they would take all their money, put it in a common bank account, if you will, kind of a common holding place, and each member of the community would be entitled to an equal share of the gross because they said this is fair and this is equal. And this will make everybody the same. We all start from the same kind of, you know, slate. We're all going to be there. You know, all the land they cleared, the houses they built, the belongings of the communities they had. And what's amazing is, Greg, now let me say this before I even read this next sentence. These were not ideologues. And what that means is ideology. They did not come over with a preconceived notion of a government that would work or wouldn't work. These weren't people that left Britain or Europe saying...
They were just escaping tyranny.
Yeah, they didn't come over saying, you know what? We're going to go over and establish capitalism. Because we think capitalism is the way to go. They didn't say, well, you know what? We're going to go over and establish socialism because we believe socialism is the way to go. But this is where it gets interesting to me in our modern history because this deals, I had no idea how much socialism and capitalism is right in the middle of the Thanksgiving story. It's simply a part of the history. But it's interesting to me because it was at the founding of our nation, and now we're seeing this issue come up again with capitalism and socialism. Which should we do? Which works better? Whatever. Well, when they established, this was their original establishment. Everyone started equal. Everyone got the same thing. Everything that everyone earned all went into the same till, and they would divide it among each other. And as the money came in, they would pay back their debtors and start their new lives. In essence, their very first form, America's first form of official government, if you go back to the Pilgrims, was socialism. We started as a socialistic nation, if you want to look at it that way, it was a short-lived, but we started that way. So somebody might be saying, no, that's impossible. We didn't. No, we did. Our history shows that William Bradford established a socialistic society when they landed. And again, I'm not saying he was a socialist. No. He was not.
We'll talk about some new people that they're in a new group that did the same thing later.
Yes. Again, but why did they do this? Because to the human mind, this is the most fair. We all pitch in together, we all work hard together, and we all get the same result, and so it's very appealing. And this is why even today, socialism on the surface is appealing.
It's full of good intentions.
Yes, the problem is human nature. We'll get to it in a moment.
Yes.
Now, again, nobody owned anything. Everything was owned by the community. Everybody had equal share of it. They decided they would distribute it equally. Everybody would get the same, and all the land cleared, again, everything. And get this, and this is kind of funny because the writer even put it, they even had organic vegetables, which is true. They would have even had organic vegetables. It would have been the perfect socialist society, all organic, everything, because you didn't have all the pesticides yet. So this would have been this would have been what many of our next generation thinks would be the utopia.
Yes.
And you could even grab that. See, their founding fathers did it. We didn't get back to it. No, well, it'd be finished. It was a miserable failure. Listen to what happened. Bradford, who had become the new governor of the colony, recognized as time went by that their system was failing. Now, this is in his own writings. He said the problem was they weren't making any money or profit from all of their work to pay off their sponsors that had sent them over to the new land because everyone was getting an equal share. Some were working, some were not working, and those that were not working were taking all the money, getting the equal share from those that were working, so it balanced everything out to where everybody had something to eat and to live on, but they couldn't make enough money to pay their debts off. So they basically were stuck in this cycle of non-profitability, non-moving forward, they're just stuck.
Or being able to pay those debts off from the sponsors,
yes.
Right?
The problem, exactly, that was the point.
Yeah.
The problem was the diligent were working hard, others weren't working at all. And he realized this is failing. We're going to go under here. We're going to eventually run out of money, and we'll never pay back our debts. So what they decided was, Bradford, when he saw this, he had them as a group, they tore up the first contract, met as a community, and they wrote a new one based on what we call basically capitalism. And here's what they said. And this was not ideology. It was one failed, that was try something else. Here was their writing, the more you produce, the more you get to keep. The harder you work, the greater are the fruit of your labors. If you want a bigger home than someone else and you can't afford it, you go out and work for it and you get it. And what happened was the people that weren't working anymore, they realized because now everybody got to keep what they worked for, the people that weren't pitching in and doing their part, they were going to die. Guess what they had to do? They had to work. So when they started working, they started contributing. Now you had everybody giving income in, and eventually this thing took off and became unleashed and was a thriving economic community, history shows us. They had far greater resources now than they did under the Mayflower Compact. As everyone was working, everyone was forced to work and to pitch in. And Bradford writes about this in his journal, and he says this, that it was for this that the original pilgrims gave thanks. Not that the Indians didn't help them, not that they weren't thankful, but he said it's because God helped us to survive after that horrible first winter, and then God showed us a system that would thrive. And so they had a time of Thanksgiving. They said, now not only are we not failing, we have abundance, so we're going to invite the Indians in. Anybody that wants to come, we're going to have this big celebration and say, this is to thank God that he kept us alive and that he gave us abundance and showed us a system that we could be abundant in and thrive in the new land. Now, isn't that amazing?
You look at that
and you go, this is not a political speech, gang. This is history. Bradford said in his journal that after abandoning the original compact of socialism, that allowing the people to keep everything themselves had earned for good success, and I quote, he said, for it made all hands industrious. Once we abandoned that, all hands were industrious, not just some.
Yeah.
So as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been. There was economic growth. They had prosperity because there was personal incentive rather than everyone getting a share from the other people that were doing the work and what other people produced. There were no handouts at all from the colony. You had to go get it.
Yeah.
So the pilgrims found out they had more food, they had more money, and they were able to, again, have this big celebration for Thanksgiving and eventually, Greg, not only pay back the people over in England, in London and Holland, but word spread of the thriving new government system that these guys had established, and migrants by the droves Americans start coming to what we call America now and establish the nation.
When Bradford was referring to the failure of socialism, did he call it socialism?
No.
Or what did he call it? And we just know it
he
to be what socialism.
He just said the Mayflower
is.
Compact has failed.
Oh, failed. Okay.
And the Mayflower Compact is socialism.
Yes, gotcha.
That's what it was.
Gotcha.
So the Pilgrims had more than they could share, more than they could eat, more than they could serve each other. So they invited the Indians to join them. Get this. They set up trading posts. They exchanged goods with the Indians. Profits finally allowed them to pay off the debts to the sponsors and the merchants in London and Holland. But it was sharing the bounty that was created by the change in the governing structure that led to the plenty that allowed them to invite the Indians to share what they had. Now, after a couple of years, word began to spread, as we said, what the Pilgrims had done in this newfound prosperity, and regular ships of migrants started coming over to America from overseas. Multitudes began coming to the new world, seeking the new opportunities of religion and the new financial opportunities as well, after they heard what was happening with the Pilgrims. Free enterprise had been established, where the fruits of your labor determined what you had and what you were able to do. It was so successful, they gave thanksgiving for it, and thanked God, again, that they had survived, and God had blessed them so much they were now thriving as this new nation. Again, that's the real story of what happened. Now, what's interesting is, and we're running out of time.
Oh, yeah, and you want to know what, Pastor Mark, if this is as important as it is, you know, we can always flow this over to the second half and do whatever we want to do.
I can wrap up. We could have talked about a lot more, but I just want to wrap it up by saying this. Look, here's the deal. This is not about necessarily trying to get people to make some kind of political statement about, you know, this and that. I want to educate the next generation. Socialism has failed historically. It has failed every time it's been tried. People say, well, America can do it different. No, it is based on the fact that you are a selfless person. You're not living for self, and you're willing to share everything. That's the only way that it can thrive. And one community that was probably the most possible to thrive was the early church. They established basically socialism because it seemed fair to them and right to them to put all their money in one pot in the church and share everything with everyone. But Greg, now we know historically the same thing happened. Some people worked, some people didn't, and eventually they lost all their money and it collapsed financially. So they couldn't do that anymore. And if the early church, filled with the Holy Spirit and loving God and being as selfless as any generation has probably ever been in world history, if they couldn't do it, don't deceive yourself into thinking that unsaved Americans as a whole can do it, or even Americans that are saved can do it. Because here's the bottom line, and I'll sum it up in this. The reason that capitalism works and socialism doesn't, and neither of them are perfect. Capitalism is not perfect, but it's the fallen nature. And this is where the world will never understand this. The believer will. Because of the fallen nature, socialism is bound to fail. Why? You have to have a heart for other people for socialism to thrive. Otherwise, it will fail because some people will work, some people won't, and because of selfishness, there'll be those that'll grab everything they can, whether they're working or not, and others will be left out. So it is doomed to fail. Why? By fallen human nature, which the Bible says all of us are born sinners. Now then, okay, but we take that same sinful nature into capitalism. Why then will capitalism thrive with the sinful nature? Because it's thriving today with the sinful nature. Why is that? Because believe it or not, now Christians take that and they'll make that money and they give to others. So it has a good purpose. But why does it thrive among the unbeliever? Selfishness drives capitalism. Your desire for money, your desire for a nicer house, your desire for nicer cars, your desire for things, the very sin nature that sinks socialism causes capitalism to thrive. So among the two, both have their faults, but capitalism is the only one that's going to survive the long run because the sin nature won't kill it. It can still thrive because people are trying to get what they can. And the righteous who are not living selfishly or trying to do all that, when they do become successful, then they can do what Paul said in the scripture, work with your own hands so that you can help others that are in need. That way you can help the poor, you can help the needy, and you see actually more people are helped under that type of system where there's a reward for what you do than a system that only really doesn't reward anybody and really punishes those who are working and rewarding those who aren't. So again, I find it very interesting. Our nation started out socialistically, found out it was a failure, moved into capitalism. We've become the greatest nation on the planet because of it, and really because of God. Now our nation, Greg, has come full circle, and coming from this position of great prosperity and thriving, we have a new generation saying, let's go back to what the Pilgrims did when they first came, because they don't know that when the Pilgrims did it, it was a miserable failure. And many Christians could even fall into this trap because they don't realize the early church tried socialism as well, and it was a miserable financial failure. It collapsed because of the sin nature. Some work, some don't. All are selfish to some degree, and the only system that can thrive while man's selfishness is still alive that we know of,
right,
is capitalism.
Amazing.
And that's why capitalism is the one that you'll see stand the test of time, believer, unbeliever, whatever the case might be, regardless of your political viewpoint, it's just a historical fact.
Wow. A definite new perspective.
Isn't that great?
On Thanksgiving.
It is a great perspective.
Wow. Thank you, Pastor Mark. Folks, don't go anywhere. We will be back with articles of interest as Signs of the Times continues right here on WIAM. Up next, it's Israel in the News.
WIAM-LP
101.1 FM, Knoxville.
From the headquarters of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews in Jerusalem, this is Israel in the News. I'm Bob Sauer. On Thursday morning, Egypt brokered a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian terror group responsible for firing hundreds of rockets at Israel from Gaza since Tuesday. However, sporadic rocket fire continued even after the ceasefire was declared, and tensions remain high. Fox News' Benjamin Hall at the Israeli-Gaza border.
We had been here to show you that life was getting back to normal in southern Israel. 450 rockets were fired by the small Iranian-backed faction called Islamic Jihad. As a result of those rockets, Israel struck back.
The latest barrage of rocket attacks from Gaza came after an Israeli airstrike killed the leader of the Iranian-backed Islamic Jihad, who was responsible for ordering numerous recent attacks on Israel. Israel believes he was planning an even larger-scale attack. Fox's Trey Yingst reports from Gaza City.
In addition to rocket attacks that were previously ordered by this commander by the name of Baha Abu al-Atta, they believe that there was an attack planned to launch first anti-tank missiles and then some cover fire. This would then, according to the plan, allow Islamic Jihad fighters to infiltrate Israel using tunnels, then target Israeli troops along the border.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu met with his security chiefs alongside Israel's new defense minister, Naftali Bennett, and promised, quote, "We will carry out all the necessary actions that we have agreed on in order to continue defending the State of Israel and its citizens." According to the Times of Israel, of the hundreds of rockets fired into Israel from Gaza, a rocket landed in a home for the elderly in Ashkelon, Israel, on Wednesday, injuring a 70-year-old woman who lives there. Responding to the rocket attacks, the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews immediately launched an operation to distribute hundreds of protective vests to first response volunteers and to supply mobile bomb shelters to the people of Israel. Representatives also visited bomb shelters during the middle of the surge of rocket fire, including this one in Netivot, Israel.
I'm with the youngest and cutest heroes of Israel, the kids that are enduring this attack. We came here to bring them some snacks and some games in order to cheer them up. These kids shouldn't be the targets of the rockets, but sadly they are. And we're here with your help to protect those civilians. Thank you very much.
This has been Israel in the News, a weekly news summary presented by the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. The fellowship is asking for your prayers and help in response to this terror attack on Israel. Find out how you can help by visiting israelinthenews.org. That's israelinthenews.org. I'm Bob Sauer.
Signs of the Times now continues. Here again is your host.
Welcome back to the second half of our program where we look at Bible prophecy in the world's news that we call Signs of the Times. It's Friday, November 15th, episode 101. Along with Pastor Mark Kirk, I'm Greg Hilt. Thanks for staying with us for the second half of our program. In the first half, we were giving you a new perspective on the history of Thanksgiving, and we had talked about William Bradford,
yeah,
who was instrumental in the first colony planted here,
yeah,
that came over. And there is a statue of him. I believe it's in Massachusetts. The person that sent that to me, I don't remember. I don't think he told me where that was. But there is a inscription at the bottom of William Bradford's statue.
Yes.
In some serious King's English.
Yeah.
That Pastor Mark is not only going to read, but interpret for us.
He's giving thanks to God. And again, look at this King's English. I'll read it that way. I think it'll be clear. But he's giving thanks to God. They wrote this on a statue. And I quote William Bradford. He said, "Lastly, of which was not least, a great hope and inward zeal they had, that is this new colony, of laying some good foundation, or at least to make some way thereunto, for ye propagating and advancing ye gospel of ye kingdom of Christ in those remote parts of ye world. Yea, though they should but be even as stepping stones unto others for ye performing of such a great work." That is, hey, God, you established them, and that gave a catapult for everybody else just to build on that after that. And so, again, shows you the heart they had, the fact of their, you know, they love the Lord, they were of God, and kind of a good little capper there. So
that is,
appreciate that.
And that is, that statue is in Plymouth, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
So
I had I had a Plymouth Duster was my first car.
Was that your first car?
My first car.
I wonder, was it as old as the Mayflower?
Think about that. When they got there, if it was dry in Plymouth, it was a Duster. I mean, maybe the first thing William Bradford had was a Plymouth Duster. I never thought about that.
He, spending a lot of time dusting, he had dirt floors, and it was pretty bad.
All right.
Okay. Won't even do a drum roll for that one.
No.
All right. Articles. Okay, this one from Israel in the News. This is actually from Breaking Israel News. Dated November 6th. This is very interesting. This is so, so prophetic. Major rabbis unite in a decisive call for all Jews to return from exile. Quote, unquote, it's time.
Yes, the Bible says in the last days, God will gather the Jews back in the land. Greg, my normal reading this morning was Ezekiel 36, which talks about this. So this is exactly where I was in my normal through the Bible reading. And God said something that jumped out to me before I even read some of the articles, something that I don't know that I've noticed it, but for the first time it seemed to notice it. You know, God put the Spirit upon people, but he didn't let the Spirit live within them until Jesus came, because the Spirit wasn't given yet. When Jesus died on the cross, it made it possible for the Spirit to come and live inside of us. But prior to that, due to sin, the Spirit couldn't live inside of us permanently. It only came upon us and was with us. He would temporarily put his Spirit inside of a prophet or someone, maybe just for a short amount of time.
Yeah.
But then he would withdraw that, because the Spirit couldn't live there, because the sins hadn't been paid for yet. And so the Lord couldn't dwell in that presence. But he says when he brings them back in the last days, here's how we know it's in reference to the last days. He said, when I bring you back and gather you, I will put my Spirit within you. So this is what it's talking about in Ezekiel 36, the last days. God's going to regather the nation of Israel. And here it is in a rare consensus or impressive array of some of the most prominent rabbis of this generation. They came together in a declaration saying there are no longer any valid excuses. Jews must act on the Torah commandment to move to Israel. Again, Ezekiel 36, exactly what God said would happen in the last days. And we're already watching happen. But again, this is like more of a mandate. You've got to come
now. This is a mandate now.
To the religious Jew.
Yes.
The consensus came as the first stage in an ongoing multifaceted project initiated by Joshua Wander, a resident of the Mount of Olives. This stage was timed to coincide with the week in which Jews around the world read the section of the Torah in which God tells Abraham to leave his father's land. Again, this is Genesis 12:1, his fatherland. He says, go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land I'll show you. And again, the Jews read the same thing worldwide in their readings. There are many sections of the Torah in which they say, in which the connection to the land of Israel is not so clear. They told Israel, Breaking Israel News, but in this section, the relationship between God and the Jewish people begins with God telling Abraham to move to Israel. The target audience is specifically religious Jews, Wander said. This message is very simple. Make aliyah now. It's time to come home. And I quote, the vast majority of even religious Jews in America do not think about aliyah anymore, Wander said. The rabbis are declaring that this is an obligatory mitzvah. So they're saying you have to do this to obey the word of God. If you decide that you cannot perform this mitzvah or aliyah, a special dispensation is required. In other words, you've got to get something from a rabbi giving you an excuse. You have to get an excuse from the principal why you can be in the hall. And this dispensation is only temporary if you can't perform it. So even if we give you a break, it's only temporary. You have to figure out how to enable your children to perform this requirement. So you as parents, we may let you out of it because it's too much of a hardship in your life, but we're not going to give you extension. Your kids are going to have to find a way to get her to Israel. So they're basically saying, now you got a mandate, you got to come back. And there'll be some that probably will respond to this. There'll be others that won't respond to this, but this is exactly what the Bible says in the last days. As we've seen, God has regathered the Jews back in the land, but he's going to continue to regather them, Greg, assimilate or accumulate them there, assimilate them there as well, and then pour out his spirit on them right after the Ezekiel 38 and 39 battle, and they're going to know Jesus is their Lord, and we're like right at the very doors of Jesus coming back.
You know, there are three types of stories that come out of Israel that for a prophecy buff, or really any Christian that believes in Bible prophecy, needs to pay special attention to. That is, when the Jews start talking about their Messiah, when the Jews start talking about rebuilding the third temple, and when the Jews start talking about returning to Israel.
There you go.
When you hear those three things coming out of the mouth of that nation, that is a prophetic barometer on exactly how close we are. We wouldn't see all sorts of things in the news and think the end is near, right? No. When we start hearing stuff out of Israel specifically like that, we need to pay attention.
Absolutely.
Because, man, that confirms for you just, you know, that we are that much closer, because God is preparing them for what's going to happen with them.
Yeah.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Greg, that is so good, because this is where reality comes in. You know, again, it's one thing for us as Bible-believing Christians in America to say what we think is going to happen. When you see it happening, and with people who don't believe in Jesus, it's happening. It's time to wake up. Reality is real. The Bible said it. It's happening. And so all the more reason to get excited. God is gathering his people back in the land, our future brothers and sisters in Christ, and we need to stand with them and support them.
Yes. But first,
we sing this song.
We've got a little bit of a battle to deal with.
Uh-oh.
Or actually, God has a battle to deal with.
Right.
In Ezekiel 38 and 39, which Pastor Mark will get there in a few days in his Bible reading.
That's right.
Because he's in 36
right.
right now.
That's right.
All right, jpost.com. This is dated November 13th. The Islamic Jihad says it's not ready for a ceasefire. However, they just said on Israel in the news that Egypt brokered a ceasefire.
Yeah, they did.
So is this news right here a little bit old?
It is old, but it's still I left it in here because it brings up the point, and that is, yes, there's been a ceasefire brokered. However, last I heard, there's still a rocket or two flying back and forth, so I don't know if it's 100%. But the bottom line is, yes, like every so often, there's always the hatred for Israel. Their neighbors are always lobbing rockets from time to time. Here we go again. And again, you know, they've over 400 some rockets, Greg, in 48 hours coming in on them. Imagine living under that, and then the people around the world have the gall to say to them, how dare you fight back and shoot into Gaza? It's like, well, let me tell you something. 400 and something rockets are flying into your neighborhood, you're going to be doing something.
Yes.
And if you don't, then shame on you, because you don't care about your neighbors or your children. Netanyahu said this: we'll not tolerate the attack on our citizens. And last year, we accumulated a mass of these attacks. He threatened to continue targeting Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders on Wednesday, as the terrorist group that was far from ready to engage in ceasefire talks. Again, that was Wednesday. We're not going to ever do it. And of course, now they've done it. And, so, and at this point, only 220 rockets, now over 400. But again, the bottom line remembers this. And 2 points I want to make. One is, Netanyahu's not going to put up with it, and I don't blame him. He should do something. But Greg, here was in the ceasefire, here was their recent request. They said, we'll give you a total ceasefire if you promise not to target the Islamic Jihad leaders. Let me explain why that is so funny. Not funny, but ironic, and you'll get what I mean by funny in a bad, not in funny way. These Islamic leaders, the reason they're targeting them is they're plotting to kill all the Jews. They're making plans, and right on the verge of killing the Jews, Israel goes in and kills them. So what they're saying is, stop killing the people that are planning to kill all of you, and if you agree to stop killing the people that are trying to kill you, we'll have a ceasefire. Which means, basically, let us kill you. I mean, when you really think it through, what they're asking, it is absurd. No, the answer is no. Again, and how do I say this? No. And so, again, we'll see about this ceasefire and how well it holds. But Israel is more than able to handle themselves.
When things don't make sense, that's when you know you're in a spiritual battle.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right, how about some American news? You liking your smartphone? You liking your smart watch? You liking your internet accounts?
There you go.
Your emails, your online, your apps that you've subscribed to, especially when it comes to your health? Well, check this out. WallStreetJournal.com, WSJ.com reporting Google's secret Project Nightingale, gathering personal health data on millions
of
Americans.
Alexa's everywhere. She's in your living room, your bedroom, bathroom, your watch, your phone.
Well, we're going to get to Alexa. We'll deal with Google. Let's deal with Google right now. In the next story, we're going to deal with Alexa.
Yeah, but it's all linked. Trust me. We covered this last week, Greg. Remember, we talked about the health issues. Search giant is amassing health records from Ascension facilities in 21 states, patients not yet informed. Google launched the effort last year with the Ascension of the country's second largest system. Google is teaming up with the world's largest healthcare system on a secret project to collect and crunch the detailed personal health information of millions of Americans across 21 states. It will be eventually across all of America, according to the people familiar with the matter in the documents. The initiative, codenamed Project Nightingale, or
here comes Florence Nightingale.
There you go. appears to be the largest in a series of efforts in Silicon Valley giants to gain access to personal health data and establish a toehold in the massive health care industry. Now, why would they be doing this? So, Greg, I want to just say this. Well, let me read one more thing.
Okay,
the data involved in Project Nightingale includes lab results, doctor diagnosis, hospitalization records, among other categories, and amounts to a complete health history, complete with patient names, dates, and birth. Again, neither patients nor doctors have been notified, and at least 150 Google employees already have access to much of the data of tens of millions of patients, according to a person familiar with the matter. Here's why this is huge and prophetic. Number one, why are they gathering all your health information? Remember, we talked last week. Isn't it great to have all these devices that tell you your heart rate, how you're doing with your cholesterol, how you're sleeping at night, how all these things, even the thing, your phone, how well did you sleep? All of these things, they're gathering all this information because they know one day we're going to have a united healthcare system. It's going to be one. And they're going to have to, and because it's a socialized, which we talked about in the Thanksgiving issue in the first half, there's only so much money. You're not going to have enough money to meet everybody's needs for the doctor visits. So this is what they do right now in Canada and in Europe and other places that have socialized health care. They only give it to those they consider to be the best candidates for the health care. So how do they know the best candidates? In your mind, you might have thought, well, that's just going to the doctor. That'll be a shame. They'll find out. No. They're already amassing all of your information through these devices. They're putting them on file and on record. When they pull the trigger, pull the switch.
Yes.
I'm making new words in one.
Yeah, you.
When they pull that switch for the healthcare records and all this stuff for everybody, and say we're going to do this socialized medicine thing, the payer, one payer, you know, et cetera, and all that. Here's what's going to happen: all your information, they're going to have it. And when you go for a procedure, they're going to say, well, you know what, Mr. Hilt, we'd love to be able to give you that heart surgery, but I've been watching your sleeping patterns, and you're not breathing good at night, and your heart rate's been bad, and you're really a prime candidate for heart attack. We'd like to help you, but we're not going to be able to, but I will give you some medicine that will make you comfortable. And if it gets bad, we'll give you some medication so it won't be hard. You think I'm joking? This is already happening to some degree. They're gathering all this information, and they're going to use this against us at the proper time. It will be a way to control the society, control the environment, and it's going to link right in again into this one-world system that the Antichrist is going to put into place. I mean, this stuff is insidious, but this is not conspiracy stuff, guys. Go read your newspaper. This is happening.
Speaking of things that are happening, technologyreview.com is reporting on inside Amazon's plan for Alexa, which I know that you personally love Alexa.
That's right.
And everything she records about your life.
Yes.
Amazon's plan for Alexa to run your entire life.
We since then have shut Alexa down. Sonos, I'll say this before you read the article, Sonos runs off of Alexa, and I didn't realize they record what's going on in your home.
I
saw Fox News said, Alexa is recording what's going on in your home. I said, no, there's no way. So I jumped online to the address they gave, and I started listening to all these conversations between me and my wife and my kids, and anybody can go get it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a secret passcode to get in.
Right.
Wow. And I'm like, okay, so if I want to know what Greg and Ann are talking about, you know, maybe I don't know. Greg's had an attitude lately. I'm going to check out what's happening in his house.
Why do you always use me as an example?
Because you're sitting right across from me. All right. Okay.
You pick somebody else.
So Pastor Travis.
Travis. Well, no, just make up a name.
Okay. Like... All right. Humperdinck.
Oh, there you go.
Humperdinck has an attitude. And I want to hear what's happening with Humperdinck. And
yes.
And I want to hear whether he's, you know, whether he thinks that, you know, his wife is a witch. You know? Heberding. Sorry, that comes from a movie. But anyway, so the bottom line is they can listen into your home. And you say, yeah, but that only runs for a few seconds while it listens to your voice. So you can say, hey, Alexa, that's why. Even Siri does the same. They've got some, it has to be running so it can hear you say, hey, Siri. It's got to be running so it can hear you say, hey, Alexa. And the claim is it only runs for like 30 seconds or whatever. A lot can be said in 30 seconds. And here's the clincher. Even if it turns off after 30 seconds, it's got to be, something's got to be on that activates it. Maybe the Hey Siri, Hey Alexa activates it. But if they have the technology, Greg, to have it on recording, listening to what you want to do as you give it the verbal instructions, that means they have the technology, if they so chose, under a FISA warrant, to turn it on and leave it on. We want to know what's going on in Pastor Mark's home 24/7. And he's got Sonos speakers all around his house. I don't, so... But imagine, I'm pretending to give you an example. This whole smart home technology, it seems so wonderful. And all the advertising, oh, yeah, it's great. But the bottom line is, they literally can hear what's going on in your home if they want 24/7. They can get all your health information, as we just talked about. It's total control that Satan is putting in place. And by the way, for the smart home stuff, I want to say this. People say, yeah, use your phone to lock your door and to open it and this kind of thing. Have you heard of hackers? I mean, if they can hack into the most sophisticated governmental systems, don't tell me that crooks can't figure out how to hack into your smart home and unlock your door when you're not there and just walk in to steal your stuff. I'm saying, guys, be careful. You know, all this stuff is great ease of life, but you can also really put yourself in big trouble.
How about Alexa offering connections to your bank where you can say, hey, Alexa, withdraw $500 or transfer
Bingo.
Five. And they talk. I mean,
did you read this article?
No, I didn't.
Did I just nail it?
Because my thing is this: anyone can come into your home and talk to Alexa. It doesn't only respond to your voice. It's anyone that says the wake word.
Interesting.
It's not. You know what I mean? It's not like your voice is a unique fingerprint like Touch ID
right.
on a smartphone or a phone or anything like that. That's biometric. Alexa's not like that. I can walk into your home right now, Pastor Mark, and say, "Hey Alexa, transfer $500 to Greg Hilt's account."
She'd start laughing because she'd say,
"He doesn't have any." Anyway, I'm just using that as an example that anyone could do that if you paired, you know, Alexa to the bank app, you know, that goes behind the scenes that they partner with. Anyway, just making that illustration.
Well, it's interesting because in this article, Greg, and I'm not going to read all of it for time's sake.
We got plenty of time.
Okay, because I thought, well, we had more articles.
We just have one more.
That's it?
That's it.
All right, well, let's just start.
Because there were others you told me to remove.
Well, then we have plenty of time. All right.
Yes, we do.
Alexa is
not that
now,
slow.
Okay. Alexa's now distributed everywhere, capable of controlling more than 85,000 smart home products, from TVs to doorbells to earbuds. It can execute over 100,000 skills, they call it, and counting. It processes billions of interactions a week, generating huge quantities of data about your schedule, your preferences, your whereabouts. Alexa has turned into an empire, and Amazon is only getting started. The idea is to turn Alexa into an omnipresent companion that actively shapes and orchestrates your life. This will require Alexa to get to know you better than ever before. For example, I'm reading straight from the article. By asking to book movie tickets, talked about doing things at your bank.
Yeah.
Alexa
yeah.
would then follow up and say whether you wanted to make a restaurant reservation or call an Uber as well. From a technical perspective, all this would be an incredible achievement, combining various data sources and machine learning methods to conduct high-level reasoning has been a goal of artificial intelligence researchers for decades. From a consumer's perspective, however, these changes also have critical privacy implications. The vision effectively assumes Alexa will follow you everywhere, know a fair bit about what you're up to at any given moment, and be the primary interface for how you coordinate your life. At the baseline, this requires hoovering up enormous amounts. That's right. That's the word.
Hoovering.
Enormous amounts of intimate details about your life. Some worry, you think, that Amazon will ultimately go far beyond that baseline by using your data to advertise and market you. Listen, that wouldn't be my concern. They're saying advertise and marketing? No, I would think they'd use it to control your life. And I quote, this is ultimately about monetizing the daily lives of individuals and groups of people. The ultimate vision is to make Alexa available and useful for everyone, even in developing countries. Now, that struck me, that last line. Because you think, well, how will the Antichrist control the world? This is only in technological play. No, what they're trying to do, Greg, with Amazon and Alexa, is they're trying to make it work even for those who don't have money to cover it so they can go in and somehow still have them connected and monitor them as well. Again, which goes right in line with a socialistic type approach. However, it also gives control over everyone. And let me tell you just some of the basic things. You know, listen, if you're living a life that's not exactly upright right now, if you're living in adultery or you got some sin or you're doing things you don't want people to know about, guess what? When it comes time for them to ruin your life because you're running for election or you're trying to get into this and that, all they have to do is say, you know, we got this FISA warrant and we found out that, Mark's been eating Tootsie Rolls from all over town at all the dollar stores. He's buying these bags of those new candy-coated, which I am. I'm coming clean on air. He's buying those candy-coated Tootsie Rolls. And you know what? That explains the weight gain and that explains the sugar, approach and all these things. So this is why he would not be an appropriate pastor for your event because too many Tootsie Rolls. Now, but here's the point.
No, but here's...
You should be caught, number one. God will expose us. But I'm saying you will have zero privacy.
So then you go to your Amazon account...
Right.
...to order your new bag of Tootsie Rolls. Alexa decides that you've had too many.
Oh, stop it, Alexa. That's where we break up. And
it sends you a bag of broccoli.
Oh, my goodness. I'm serious. That's where we break up. She's out of that. No, we're done. That's it. The relationship's over at that point. Alexa's got to go in. She's got to go in. We've been on the Tootsie Rolls or we're in big trouble. I can tell you that right now.
Oh, my.
It's true. That's it.
Oh, is that it? Yeah. Oh, you were looking like I thought you had more to share.
No, looking for you to lead us to the next article. No, that's it. That's the bottom line. Here's the bottom line. Just be aware. Before we go on, let me say this to our listeners. I don't want you to be afraid to use your smartphone, your technology. I love the smartphone. I love my computer.
I love technology.
I love the technology and the convenience. I mean, it's just fun. It's really cool to be able to pick up your phone and run your TV or do whatever. I mean, these are cool things.
Yes.
Or open your door. I get it. But use wisdom, believer, because... If you get too connected to too many of these things with too much information, you are an open book to be, if the government turns, if they turn on a dial against Christians or anything, you are going to be an easy pickings right off the bat. I'm not saying, go dig bunkers and go into hiding. Live life. Enjoy yourself. Just be aware of what's going on out there and be aware who's listening into your home and decide, do I want them listening in or not?
Yeah, good point. All right, our last article of the day is some good news. A Rwandan genocide survivor said that God used a Christmas shoebox to save him as a child.
Yeah, we had a couple of these shoebox articles, Greg, that were so wonderful, and I just lift one since they both kind of cover it. But again, a man who fled to Rwanda, the Rwandan genocide as a boy, and who saw his life change when he received an Operation Christmas Child shoebox, is now traveling the U.S. and encouraging others to fill shoeboxes this holiday season. Alex, I'm not going to say his last name's family, was killed during the 1994 genocide that saw as many as 800,000 people murdered. He was bitter and blaming God, he said. But during that tragedy, a small box filled with gifts from Christians gave him hope. He was 7 at the time. And I quote, both my grandmother and my uncle, the people who were taking care of me, were killed during the war. And I would run from family to family, he said, at the Calvary Baptist Church in Longview, Texas, according to KLTV. By the end of the genocide, I was put in an orphanage. And while I was in this orphanage, that's when Samaritan's Purse, the mother organization of Operation Christmas Child, brought shoeboxes to us. Just having something that we could call our own, that we could play with, and that could take our minds off of what happened during the war. Receiving that shoebox was just the beginning of my faith, he said. It reminded us that someone out there cares. Listen, what a great way to end the show. And I want to encourage all of you, if God gives you the opportunity and you have the ability to be involved in Operation Christmas Child, what a great ministry they have worldwide. It's not just giving gifts. They actually give tracts in there. They give a discipleship class in there. And they follow up in the areas where they take these gifts with discipleship classes, leading these children and adults to the Lord and then giving them discipleship when they're there. So I can't brag on an organization more than Samaritan's Purse. Tremendous God-raised-up organization, Franklin Graham, Bill Billy Graham's son leading it up. But again, just to remember, this time of year, what they're doing is they're taking a time of year that is known for giving and sharing and love, and they're using it to bless these kids, and it's leading multitudes to Christ. So, number one, not only be involved in that if you can be, but number two, even if you can't be involved in Operation Christmas Child, remember, this is a wonderful time of year to show the love of Jesus Christ. And do good things for people. Love them. Show them that love. And when they ask you, say, it is for this reason. It's because Jesus died for you on a cross. And if you will confess your sin and believe in him, he will give you a place in heaven forever. He loves you that much, and I want you to know his love. And so we make that extension, that opportunity right now to our listeners, as well as give you that encouragement to those of you that are believers. Share the love of Christ this holiday season. Let it begin now. Listen, it's already kicked off. So enjoy it. You know, don't worry about the lights going up too quick. Go out and enjoy those lights. Enjoy Thanksgiving. Get ready for everything. Give thanks to the Lord. Give praise to the Lord. Bless other people. Show God's love during this season. And again, use this as an opportunity to lead people to Christ. And if you don't know the Lord, then you need to make that decision today. Look, the holiday, the reason, it sounds corny, the reason for the season, it truly is Jesus. And if you don't know him, you're probably going to have a miserable, stressed time here coming up over these next month and a half. But if you know him, you can enjoy the joy that Jesus brings in salvation and loving others and loving you as well. So God bless you guys, and enjoy the holidays.
Absolutely. Pastor Mark, thank you. Folks, don't forget thesigns.org. And don't forget, we will not be back until Friday, December 6th, for our next live show. So in the meantime, if you want a prophecy fix, just head to thesigns.org and make sure to join us Friday, December 6th for more Signs of the Times right here on WIAM.